searching for life on Mars, and remembering the final space shuttle mission 15 years later. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. For the second installment of Space on Tap, a special Are We There Yet? Live events series, we talked about Mars and what scientists and their robotic co-workers are really looking for on the red planet.
If life arose on Earth at this time with similar conditions, why not on Mars?
We hear from University of Florida's Amy Williams about her work searching for signs of life on Mars. Then, a look back at the last space shuttle mission. The crew of the final shuttle mission, STS-135, reunited for the mission's 15th anniversary.
It is still a miracle of technical achievement that ever existed.
We'll speak with Commander Chris Ferguson about his experience and the space shuttle's legacy. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? For our second installment of Space on Tap, a special event series from Are We There Yet?, we recorded a live segment speaking with University of Florida's Amy Williams about her career working with rovers on Mars and studying the red planet. This show was recorded live on Wednesday, July 8th at Ace Cafe Sanford here in Florida. Here's our conversation now. Dr. Amy Williams is an astrobiologist from the University of Florida and a scientist on the Mars Curiosity and Perseverance rovers. She's on the show regularly to bring us up to speed on the latest space news from the Red Planet, and today she is here to talk about her work, which is searching for signs of life on Mars. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Amy Williams. You are an astrobiologist, which is a very cool title. What does that do? What do you do?
I get to play with Mars rovers. I feel like that's enough. No, is that enough?
Yeah.
The job. The job really is, what is an astrobiologist? I'm interested in whether there's life beyond Earth. I spend most of my time thinking about if that life was made of little tiny microbes like our bacteria. And so I focus on how we can build instruments to identify evidence for that bacteria, whether it's present today or if it was ever present in the past on Mars.
Why does that matter? Who cares?
These folks, I hope.
I'm sure they do, yes. But I have to ask the tough questions.
Yes.
Why is this important?
Right. You're right. My motivation started when I was little, and so I'm super excited to see that there are some representatives of younger generations in the room here. I would watch the stars with my family, I would look out into the night sky, and I would wonder if there was another little girl out there somewhere in the cosmos looking out into her night sky and wondering if she was also alone. And I found this to be motivational throughout my career. I didn't know astrobiology was a field until I got to graduate school and had the opportunity to join a rover mission. And for me, why this is important is that it makes us more cognizant of how small and fragile and precious we all are, of how important it is for us to see beyond ourselves, to explore beyond ourselves. That's what drives me to be an astrobiologist and to look for little tiny microbes on other worlds. Mm-hmm.
And today you're here to announce that we found them, right?
No, that is incorrect, sir.
I thought we had a scoop. Well, why are you looking at Mars?
If you think about how our solar system formed, and I will defer to the astrophysicists that may actually be in the room here, what we have are two worlds, Earth and Mars, that formed very similarly. They had very similar compositions early on. And both worlds had water early on in their past. In fact, Mars had water at the time when we expect that life originated on Earth. And so it begs the question, if life arose on Earth at this time with similar conditions, why not on Mars? So Mars has become a really great testing ground for us to build new instrumentation, next generation instruments and vehicles to help us try to address the question of whether there is life beyond Earth. It's relatively easy in the grand scheme of things to launch and land on Mars at this point. And we can actually operate for an extended period of time on the surface. And so both the potential for life having existed in the past on Mars, as well as our ability to test instrumentation that we can then send out into the outer solar system, makes Mars a really great sort of testing ground and proving ground for these types of experiments.
What are you actually looking for? Because in our conversation, and I think we've determined that you've been on the show for more than 3 years at this point. So you've been coming on, giving us updates on Mars. In our conversations, sadly, I've learned they will not be like Marvin the Martians that you are finding. You're looking for something else. What do you think that you will find on Mars if there really was life in the past?
What we're looking for when we look for life on Mars are things that we call biosignatures. So this can range from little tiny structures preserved in the rocks to little tiny chemicals preserved in the rocks. So I'm actually a geologist. That is my core study, and I've applied that field to astrobiology. And what we're looking for are things that we actually see in the rock record on Earth from billions of years ago. Sometimes there are these tiny little crenulations in rocks that are actually evidence for basically
picture. Did you say crenulation?
A crenulation, yes. Like, picture little tiny wavy marks in rocks. These can actually build on top of each other and form larger and larger structures that we refer to generally as stromatolites. These are some of the earliest evidence for life on Earth, and it's one of the things that we like to look for on Mars, but we're starting to realize that Mars is very, we've already known this, right, that Mars is very challenging. And so what we're trying to do is become more nuanced in our study. We're not going to see evidence for an individual bacterium preserved in a rock, but we might see some of the chemicals that were part of the biochemistry of that organism. And those are the kinds of things that we are searching for, trying to find foundational evidence that can build to a story of potential life on Mars. We're not quite there yet, but we've had some really exciting discoveries recently that I think are starting to build an interesting story that Mars is a dynamic world, maybe more dynamic than we originally expected when we started exploring not quite 100 years ago.
Not to take away from the complexity of your work, but essentially you are looking for fossilized farts on Mars, are you not?
I think we call those clathrates, but yes, sir.
That's a really fancy name for that.
Fine.
You are looking for whatever that word is for fossilized farts, using two coworkers that are on another planet, and that is NASA's Curiosity rover and NASA's Perseverance rover. Tell me a bit about what it's like to work with robots. Is it better than people?
They don't talk back to you too often,
okay.
But sometimes they drive in circles.
Okay.
So you have to ask them to not do that very politely. It's an incredible opportunity to work on the rover missions. These are teams of 400 plus scientists and engineers who show up every day. We get downlink from our deep space network. We look at the images and the data that come back from the rover, and we make a decision about where to go next. Now, we have a long-term plan. That's one of my roles on the Perseverance mission, to make sure that we're meeting our long-term goals on the timeline that we need to. And so we already know, you know, we need to get to that rock over there. So we ask the rover drivers to drive us over there. Maybe we have to go around an obstacle. We can ask the vehicle to drive itself sometimes, and sometimes we need to give it a little bit of assistance. When we get over to that rock, maybe it has something that looks like little crenulations in it. We're very interested to explore that. And so we direct our instruments to perform different experiments in order for us to characterize the elements, the chemistry, the mineralogy, what the rock is made of, are there organic molecules? These are the kinds of things that we can, the data that we can collect. And so we ask the rover to do this by basically writing code. We send the code back up, which is called uplink, to our deep space network. That goes to the orbiters around Mars. It goes down to the robot. And that's the cycle of every day. And I will say that right now we plan on we can plan multiple days. So maybe we plan on a Wednesday and we won't have to plan again till Friday. When you first land one of these missions, you operate on Mars time, which is 24/7, except Mars is 24 hours and 39 minute long days.
Hmm.
And so we actually stagger our life schedule to meet the Mars time frame for the first 3 months of these missions.
That is really interesting. Yeah.
And exhausting.
And exhausting.
Yes.
and it takes a long time to get data to and from there, right? If you want to say, Curiosity, go over here, it won't do that right away, right?
Right. It's not in real time. We do have a high gain antenna, which you use sort of for, it's lower data availability, both uplink and downlink. And so we have to use the orbiters that are actually able to receive and send much larger data volume. So we don't communicate with the rover in real time, which would be a 14-minute light delay. We actually tell the robot what to do. uplink those data. It does it hopefully while we're sleeping and then sends the data back to us. So we're on a more reasonable schedule where we can send more data and receive more data and also sleep at normal time.
We're going to go ahead and turn it over to you all for a few questions. Your hand shot up immediately. So we are going to go to you first. Wait for the mic to come around.
Let's suppose you find the evidence that you're looking for. What's the implication for humankind?
Well, that depends on everyone's take on things. It's a profound discovery. It's paradigm shifting, and it has implications not just for the scientific communities, but for how we experience our experience as humans, as a species on a world that we're discovering there are species beyond this world. So there are things I think that are outside the sphere of what science is going to be able to direct. So I mean, we're not going to tell anybody how to feel about that discovery, right? I think that's going to be something that everyone gets to come to grips with in their own way. I think what's important is a rigorous explanation for the discovery, for making sure that it is intelligible to everyone, so I don't have to talk, you know, use the jargon of my field to explain it. I need to be able to make this very clear to everyone who wants to understand what the discovery means. I think that it does have implications for how people view themselves in the world, and I think it's going to be a conversation that will be had over and over again. I think what's important is that we are open to that conversation and open to the dialogue that comes with it.
Geologists on Earth have to do a lot of digging to find the things they want. And I think I heard you say...
Digging. Yes, okay.
And I think I heard you say 6 centimeters is about as deep as we've gone so far. Mm-hmm. What kind of plans do we have to get a little deeper and see what's down underneath that? Great.
Grab a shovel, Jim.
What an excellent question. You were not even like placed in the audience for that question. That was perfect. Yes, it is. 6 centimeters is not a very deep drill hole. And so you have to start somewhere, right? You got to test the technology out. And so actually the Rosalind Franklin rover, which is the life detection rover from the ExoMars mission, which is part of the European Space Agency with contributions from NASA, is launching in 2028, finally has a ride. Yes, this is important. And this vehicle will have a 2-meter drill, so unprecedented access into the subsurface that should reach below sort of the radiation zone so that you can actually see materials that are unimpeded from that harsh radiation environment. So that is the next step. Beyond that, there's a lot more technology development that needs to happen, but you know, if money is available to go into R&D, we can build it. So that's what we need, support to move the next generation of drills and technology forward.
I've got time for one more question.
Hi, hello. Earlier you brought up the clouds on Mars. What color are the clouds on Mars and what are they made out of?
Excellent questions. As a not atmospheric scientist and as a dirty feldspar jockey, I can say that there is water ice in the clouds. I always mispronounce it, so someone check me on it, noctilucent, noctilucent, something like that. Clouds that form, I think, in the high atmosphere, and they are a lot of water ice, so they're sort of, from the images we have, kind of like that, like iridescent-y, like it's like little rainbows. It's pretty cool, though.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
That was our conversation with University of Florida's Amy Williams, an astrobiologist and member of the Mars Rover Science Team. It was taped at Ace Cafe Sanford as part of Are We There Yet's Space on Tap special event series. Stay tuned for the next Space on Tap event, which is in October. More details to come at cfpublic.org/spaceontap. Still to come, reflecting on the space shuttle era 15 years later.
You know, when you sort of take it all in, I mean, sometimes I just look at it. And it's hard to believe that, you know, we used to pack that thing full of fuel and people and stuff and stand it on its tail and strap it to a rocket and send it into space.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. For 30 years, NASA's Space Shuttle program launched 135 missions, helping build the International Space Station and launching important payloads like the Hubble Space Telescope. Its final mission, STS-135, was back in July of 2011. Launching from the Kennedy Space Center, a crew of four embarked on a 12-day journey before the Space Shuttle Atlantis's successful landing back here in Florida.
Nose gear touchdown. Having fired the imagination of a generation, a ship like no other, its place in history secured, the Space Shuttle pulls into port for the last time, its voyage at an end.
The entire crew of four reunited on Saturday at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. They spoke beneath the Space Shuttle Atlantis, which flew them on their mission. I caught up with Commander Chris Ferguson after that reunion to reflect on his career and the Space Shuttle program. Chris, welcome to Are We There Yet? Thanks for chatting with us.
Great to be here. Yeah. It's a great opportunity. 15 years, we haven't been together as a crew in a long time, so it's been, I think, 10 years. It's
wow. Amazing. Yeah. What was it like to get back together?
We met yesterday and had dinner, and we just sat and chatted for 3 hours. There's a lot of catching up. You know, more about, you know, how's your family doing? What are the kids doing? You know, I mean, Doug's son was like 2 when we launched, and mm-hmm. now he's driving. Mm-hmm. So it gives you a very good sense of the passage of time. But everyone's doing well. And we have been in touch. We just haven't all been together as one group.
And it's a unique reunion because it was underneath the orbiter that took you all to space for that final time in Atlantis. What is it like to see that shuttle in person again?
I've been here, I'd say at this point, dozens of times. Mm-hmm. But you know what? There's never something new that I don't notice. Either looking from underneath or looking from the side. And, you know, when you sort of take it all in, I mean, sometimes I just look at it. And it's hard to believe that, you know, we used to pack that thing full of fuel and people and stuff and stand it on its tail and strap it to a rocket and send it into space. And, I mean, you know, it was designed 40, 50 years ago. You know, they started working on it. And it is still... a miracle of technical achievement that ever existed. Mm-hmm. And it flew and, you know, built the space station and launched incredible probes into, you know, and observatories in the low Earth orbit. And I mean, it'll live on in memories for generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take us back into the cockpit 15 years ago. You're on the pad, you're getting ready to launch. You know this is the final space shuttle mission. What is going through your mind before you leave the planet?
Well, you know, it was a rainy day, and I went back and looked at my old notes, and when we woke up in the morning, they always give you the weather prognostication, and they gave us a 70% no-go that day.
Oh, wow.
So we really thought that we were just going through an academic exercise on this one, and I've scrubbed a couple times in the past, and it's just, you know, it's not fun. So we kind of thought, well, we'll go through the motions. And a matter of fact, I even wrote down that as we were getting strapped in, it was raining, and you know, so you see, you know, water pouring all over the orbiter. And but then, you know, as we got closer, I mean, by closer I mean within 20 minutes, you know, you can actually, when you're sitting in there, you can see to the west, which mm-hmm. is the weather that's coming at you. And I said, hey guys, there's like some clear stuff coming. So we really began to believe that, hey, this might happen. And I think up to that point, we were really thinking that we're just going through the motions. You know, as the launch count came down, I mean, it was closer. And apparently the return to launch site weather that the shuttle training airplane and the pilots and the astronaut in this shuttle, they were even giving, you know, initially adverse likelihood, mm-hmm. and then it improved. So things were beginning to line up. And, you know, we had a very sort of a late hold, which was unusual. But then, you know, that all cleared up and off we went. I was amazed. Mm-hmm. And you're very happy when you do launch because you know that the nearest bathroom, if you don't launch, is probably 2 hours away. And if you do launch, it's only about a half hour away.
Okay.
So when you reach that point, you really just want to go.
What time was your launch? Were you full of coffee at that point or did you really need to go?
No, I learned after my first mission that I needed to do a couple things strategic. Yeah. And I limited myself to 1 cup of coffee and 1 bottle of water and a good run mm-hmm. in the morning. And then, so I went in, you know, without the urge to go. Mm-hmm. But What was the, let me make sure I get the full question there.
I think we were, I just asked you what time it was, yeah.
Okay. Oh, what time of the, what, yeah. I think we launched, it was like early afternoon, okay. if I remember correctly. I did write down that we actually, our time from wake up to launch was shorter than it normally been. Normally you launch at the end of your work day. That was the way sort of shuttle worked. So you were waking up, you know, 8-10 hours before you launched, and there was a lot of anticipation. You'd rather just sort of sleep until the last minute and, you know, get dressed and go. But it was shortened for us, and everything just seemed to really go quickly the day of. And, you know, well, you know the rest. We got strapped in on time, and it sort of worked, much to the belief that we didn't think it would.
It was a smaller crew. There was four of you, and one of my favorite things is watching the launch, the video from the cockpit, and it looks like just four buddies going on a road trip. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what it was like to have that smaller crew, and did that change the dynamic between you all on this mission?
Well, the one thing that was unique about it was they always try to weave a few space rookies in on every shuttle flight, and that's a lot of fun. I mean, I remember when I was on my rookie flight, I had a bunch of experienced people, and then when I had my second flight, you know, we were sort of 50-50. But this, you know, we had all been through this. We all sort of knew what to expect. We'd all worked together, and we just sort of had a rhythm that didn't need explanation. So it was sort of an easy training flow. I mean, we just sort of knew how the other person would react, and I remember things went very, very gently, you know, through the training flow. We were very busy because there were only four of us, so there were a lot of tasks that had to be divided and subdivided, but I think it was just sort of maybe the maturity and the experience, you know, we were able to get through all that. I mean, there were some modifications they made to the mid-deck. You know, normally there were a couple seats down there, and there were a couple, you know, features that we're able to sort of eliminate. So we helped, I think, design the mission a little bit so it was as efficient as it possibly could. And we were busy, there's no question about it, but everybody took everything in stride. I mean, I don't remember ever feeling, you know, scarily behind in anything. So, and it's credit to our planners too. You know, they know how to work these missions.
Back then, what did you see as Shuttle's legacy? And does it live up to that in your mind a decade and a half later?
Well, the legacy, in my opinion, you know, and that's because all three of my missions to the space station were, and I think Sandy, the last time you asked the question, I think did a very good job of explaining that it demonstrated the space shuttle's flexibility, you know, in that it had a tremendous capability to carry not only heavy payloads, but large payloads. All the observatories, you know, Hubble and Chandra, I mean, you know, there were about a half a dozen of those. But ultimately, in the end, we were able to carry the big pieces of the space station because they were not only heavy, but they were big, and assemble them all in orbit into this just incredible, you know, complex in space that's still, you know, one of my most pivotal moments I remember is as we're getting ready to dock with the space station and you're sort of just hanging out there in space, you know, maybe 600, 1,000 feet away from it, and you look at it, it's like, I cannot believe we built this thing in space. So, you know, to me, that's the big thing is being able to, you know, build space station and then, you know, have the station create sort of its own legacy, which will be, what's it like to live for a long period of time in space? And how can I reduce my dependency on mission control helping me with everything, right? A little bit of that sort of autonomy. I mean, we look at science fiction movies. We know that, you know, we watch The Martian, and you know, a lot of people are watching, you know, Project Hail Mary now, and I think they're great things, but it, you know, you fast forward 100 years, and you say, what's this all gonna be like? And it's all gonna be a lot more, I think, controlled by, you know, the vehicle, because it's gonna be too far away, you know, for real-time radio communications. And, you know, are we going to be able to fix everything that breaks? And if we can't fix it, what do we do? And so I think that the space station is giving us that sense of what is it like to live pseudo-autonomously. When we go back to the moon, which is our next plan, you know, now we're not just an hour away, we're 3 days away. And what is that, how's that changed the dynamic?
All things must come to an end, right? The space shuttle program ended. The International Space Station program will end as well in the next decade. Are you concerned that we may lose the memory of Shuttle when ISS goes away?
I don't think we'll lose the memory of Shuttle ever. I am worried that we're going to lose a little bit of our sort of running knowledge base that we have on what it's like to live in low Earth orbit, you know, if we lose something like the space station. And, you know, lose is a word, you know, if it times out and we don't have a suitable replacement, all of that knowledge we acquired on, hey, you know, how do I get to 99% water recycling? How do I, you know, be as efficient as possible in regenerating my environment? How do I keep astronauts healthy? I mean, we've learned a lot, but it's perishable knowledge. You know, it may be recorded in books and reports, but, you know, if we take a 10 or 20 year pause on having a full-time or, you know, low Earth orbit or microgravity environment to go sort of refresh our memory. And the big thing I think about is, how am I going to fix my own spaceship? Mm-hmm. What if piece parts break? You know, there's no ACE hardware down the street. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything has to have a contingency plan on top of a contingency plan. And it's just that day-to-day living with things that break in space. I hope we don't lose that ability to be incredibly innovative if we lose our full-time laboratory.
STS-135 is final space shuttle mission, but there was an opportunity for you to go back to space with Boeing. Mm-hmm. That did not happen. Do you regret that you won't get a chance to go back to space?
I believe everybody has their time and their turn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a little part of it is giving that opportunity to others. Mm-hmm. You know, for me personally with Boeing, it just strung out too long. You know, I had a much shorter time horizon where I wanted to do something like that. And it doubled and maybe even went beyond doubled. So, you know, that was a tough personal decision I had to make, and I have no regrets. It was the right thing to do, you know, for my family and me personally. Mm-hmm. But I'm still affiliated with Boeing, and, you know, I work in their safety side as a, you know, in a consultant capacity, but, you know, I've been able to leverage a little bit of my experience working with Starliner and NASA, you know, to hopefully make spaceflight safer, at least on Boeing products and hopefully in general.
Finally, Chris, is there a moment about your time on STS-135 or your previous space shuttle missions that you still relive in your head, or a moment that you would want to go back to or dream about?
You know, there is nothing that is more magical than being in space. I loved my time on the International Space Station, being sort of just a part of a very important mission to do whatever it may be, but also the camaraderie of just working with, you know, the selected International Space Station crew whose job it was day in and day out for 6 months, you know, a year to live up there. And you come up and it's just like, you know, it's just like visiting grandma's house. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's their house. You take care of it. You're a visitor. You have a job. You have to put an addition on their house. But just that camaraderie with that sort of broader mission of, you know, we're gonna explore. We're going to do a lot of science, right? We're going to learn a lot about what it's take to sustain human life, and we're going to build a huge structure. And everybody goes forward with that singular goal in mind.
Commander Chris Ferguson, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Brendan.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. If you got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetthereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. The producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Engineering support at Space on Tap comes from TJ Barnes. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.